This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The NATO chief says the mechanisms of security guarantees for Ukraine still remain to be decided by the Allies. Russia says U.S. pilots are violating safety protocols designed to deter a possible clash between the two countries in Syria. And a prominent Australian war veteran loses a defamation lawsuit in connection with charges of committing war crimes in Afghanistan. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. NATO Secretary General says Ukraine's security must be guaranteed when the war with Russia ends, but NATO allies still need to work out the mechanisms of that guarantee.
We don't know when the war ends, but we must ensure that when it does, we have credible arrangements in place to guarantee Ukraine's security in the future and to break Russia's cycle of aggression. The details, how this will be done, what kind of mechanisms, that remains to be decided.
Stoltenberg made the remarks following an informal meeting of NATO foreign ministers in the Norwegian capital, Oslo. The ministers debated providing security guarantees as NATO looks to bridge divisions over Ukraine's push to join the bloc. NATO requires consensus to make decisions. Joining NATO would mean all members must help defend Ukraine if attacked. An alternative being weighed is major powers offering Ukraine security assurances. Before the Thursday meeting, the German Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock, reiterated Berlin's position that NATO cannot be joined by a country while it is in the midst of a war.
What NATO has always made clear is the open door policy. And at the same time, it is also clear that in the middle of a war, we cannot speak about a new membership.
Foreign ministers of France and Spain echoed the call by Germany's top diplomat. They said that it would take time for members to come up with a security guarantee for Ukraine. Separately, Hungary's foreign minister voiced opposition to Ukraine joining NATO. The minister said the issue cannot be on the agenda during NATO's summit in July. He said that a timetable for Ukraine's accession should not be discussed either. Moscow has repeatedly warned against Ukraine's joining NATO. It says preventing Kiev from joining the Western military alliance remains one of the main objectives of a special military operation. Meanwhile, there appears to be no signs of a let-up in the Russia-Ukraine war, as both sides have launched fresh assaults on each other's territories. At least three people were killed in a Russian air attack on the Ukrainian capital Kiev early Thursday. Meanwhile, five people were wounded by overnight shelling of the Russian town of Shebekino that damaged several buildings as well. Two people were hospitalized as a result of the Ukrainian rocket strike. Ukraine has stepped up its attacks inside Russia, as well as in Russian-held territories in the country's eastern regions this week. Over the past couple of days, Ukrainian forces have reportedly targeted homes, a school, and industrial facilities inside Russia, leaving multiple casualties. Moscow also accused Kiev of conducting drone strikes, calling them acts of terror. Russia says the U.S. keeps violating the deconfliction protocols that were designed to deter a possible clash between forces of the two countries operating in Syria. Accusation comes from the head of the Russian Reconciliation Center for Syria. He has been quoted as saying that American pilots activate their weapon system when approaching Russian planes in eastern Syria. He describes such actions of the U.S. Air Force as gross violations of the agreed protocols. Previously, the Russian military official also condemned Washington for flying its aircraft in zones that it had agreed to not enter. Moscow has been providing aerial support to Damascus to fight terrorism. That is while the U.S. keeps maintaining its troops there without an authorization from the Syrian government. Syria accuses the U.S. of occupying its lands in order to plunder natural resources. Geopolitical analyst Ryan Dawson says by using its warplanes, the U.S. is after collecting data from Russia's air defense batteries in Syria.
First of all, the U.S. isn't supposed to be there at all. The Syrian government did not invite them there. The Russians were invited there by the head of state. The U.S. has been effectively supporting the annexation of Rojava by Kurdish factions in Syria, as well as giving covert support to ISIS Takfiri groups. There is no reason at all to be playing chicken in the air. What they're doing is they're activating their weapon systems as they get near Russian aircraft. And the protocols are there for a reason. If you're going to activate your weapon systems, and you're playing a very dangerous game of chicken, because eventually the Russians will activate their weapon systems if they think they're about to be shot at. Why would you do this? They're not doing this toward Syrian aircraft. And ISIS doesn't have an air force, unless you include Israel as their proxy air force. So why are they flexing like this and turning on their weapon systems to threaten the Russians? The only reason to do that is as a provocation to try and get things to escalate there. If the Syrian allies don't move, the U.S. will continue to escalate. This needs to be settled now with negotiations and dialogue, not this dangerous move of air-on-air chicken.
Israeli atrocities against Palestinians seem to be never-ending, as the regime refuses to consider the release of a longtime inmate, Walid Dacca, despite his advanced cancer. Last week, an Israeli court canceled the parole committee meeting that was due to consider his release. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned that the delay is an Israeli policy of slow, systematic killing of inmates. Dacca had completed his 39-year jail term in February. Last year, he was diagnosed with a rare cancer and is in urgent need of a bone marrow transplant. The news follows the recent martyrdom of another Palestinian inmate, Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who passed away after nearly 3 months of a hunger strike over his illegal detention. Israel is holding nearly 5,000 Palestinians, many of them incarcerated under the so-called administrative detention, a policy the regime pursues to keep inmates without charge or trial for an indefinite period. Israeli forces have detained dozens of Palestinians during a fresh raid on the occupied West Bank. Regime forces raided many homes in the cities of Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, and Al-Khalil. Teenagers are among 35 Palestinians detained during the assaults. Israeli forces also raided the Aqabat Jaber refugee camp in the eastern West Bank city of Ariha. Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians since the formation of a new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The regime detains Palestinians citing different pretexts. Nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks across the occupied territories this year so far. An Australian war veteran has lost a defamation lawsuit against some newspapers that had accused them of committing war crimes in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith took legal action against three newspapers and two investigative journalists for allegedly undermining his reputation. Sydney's federal court, however, has ruled that the publication successfully proved the truthfulness of reports related to the highly decorated veteran. 5 years ago, they accused Robert Smith of killing unarmed civilians, assaulting detainees, and bullying his fellow soldiers in Afghanistan. Outside of the courtroom, the winners of the case called on the Australian government to use the court's findings to investigate the crimes committed by soldiers in Afghanistan.
Now's the time for the nation and the Defence Force to absorb what the judge has found. The full findings will be released in due course. What is clear is Ben Robert Smith is a liar. I'd like Ben Robert Smith to reflect on the people he murdered, the man he kicked off a cliff, the Afghan villagers. That's what I think Ben Robert Smith should reflect on.
Robert Smith was a member of the Australian Army Special Forces, which has been embroiled in controversy over his misconduct in Afghanistan. A report published by the military in 2020 showed there was credible evidence some Australian soldiers unlawfully killed at least 50 unarmed civilians in Afghanistan. Canberra is currently investigating the incident. Australia sent its troops to Afghanistan in 2001 as part of the so-called U.S.-led coalition against the war on terror. The country pulled its troops out of Afghanistan in 2011. Foreign ministers from the BRICS countries are meeting in South Africa as the bloc seeks to counterweight the West. South African authorities have confirmed the presence of top diplomats from Brazil, Russia, and India, as well as a Chinese deputy minister in Thursday's meeting in Cape Town. The talks are a prelude to leaders' summit to be held in Johannesburg in August. No agenda has been made public, but discussions are expected to focus on ties among members and an expansion of the group. BRICS is an acronym for five economies: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It has gradually turned into a more cohesive geopolitical bloc. BRICS leaders have already hinted about admitting new members, including Iran and Venezuela. South Africa has invited the Iranian foreign minister to attend the meeting. Jose Namir of the Leon is scheduled to hold bilateral talks with his BRICS counterparts. China has urged the U.S. to stop official exchanges with Taiwan under the guise of trade.
China has always firmly opposed countries with which it has diplomatic relations having any form of official interaction with China's Taiwan region, including negotiating or signing any agreements with connotations of sovereignty or of an official nature. The relevant actions by the U.S. side severely contravene the One China Principle and the three U.S.-China joint communiques and go against the U.S.'s own commitment not to maintain unofficial contact with Taiwan. The DPP authorities are using trade cooperation as a pretext for using America to achieve independence.
The spokeswoman said Beijing has made several representations on this topic with Washington. China regards Taiwan as part of its territory under the One China Principle and rejects the island's diplomatic and military nexus with outside powers. The exchange of visits by American and Taiwanese officials in the recent past has infuriated Beijing. Despite repeated warnings, Washington has pledged to strengthen ties with the self-ruled island. Russia says the U.S. government has been exploiting Apple phones to spy on some of the device's users. Russia's Federal Security Service says it has uncovered a U.S. intelligence plot to use a previously unknown malware to spy on Apple users. The malware allegedly penetrates specially made backdoor vulnerabilities in Apple phones. The FBS said thousands of phones, including those of domestic Russian subscribers, have so far been infected. It claimed that a number of mobile devices belonging to foreign diplomats based in Russia, some former Soviet countries, and China have also been infected. The U.S. has not yet responded to the allegations. There have been no reactions from the Apple company either. Brazil's president has asked the South American countries to create a local currency for regional trade instead of depending entirely on extra-regional currencies. Addressing a summit of the South American leaders, Lula da Silva called on the Mercosur trade bloc to set up better compensation mechanisms and a shared unit of transaction for commerce. The idea of a shared currency within the Mercosur has been discussed intermittently since its establishment in 1991. Mercosur comprises of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay.
Leaders of 12 Latin American countries have held a summit in the Brazilian city of Brasilia to discuss a common strategy in a changing world. Top on the agenda was the call by the Brazilian president, Lula da Silva, to create a common currency. In his opening remarks, da Silva urged Latin American leaders to, quote, strengthen the South American identity in monetary policy through better compensation mechanisms and the creation of a shared unit of transaction for trading rather than relying on extra-regional currencies.
Historically and culturally, economically and commercially, we are one human entity with common needs and hopes. The recent elections in Colombia, Chile, Bolivia, Brazil, and Paraguay demonstrated the strength of democracy in elections marked by popular participation and a broad freedom of expression.
In Lula's vision, the single currency would apply to the Mercosur trade bloc comprised of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Lula also argued that regional development banks like the Andean Development Corporation, the Bank of the South, and Brazil's Development Bank should do more to finance social and economic development in the region. President da Silva also attempts to revive the regional bloc previously known as the Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR. Lula and other leaders co-founded UNASUR in 2008 and they last met in 2014. It ultimately fractured as the region moved to the right. The meeting underscores the shifting political climate in South America, where leftist political forces have experienced a resurgence after years of largely conservative rule.
During the summit, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro hailed the, quote, new era in relations between Caracas and Brasilia, as he met President da Silva on the sidelines of the event. Brazil had severed diplomatic relations with Maduro's government under Lula's far-right predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, who maintained close ties with Washington and backed his brutal bans against Venezuela. The new alliance is believed to herald new days of cooperation between the Latin American nations.
In in another development which heralds the shifting alliances in the region, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro received a warm welcome by Lula just several years after he was banned from entering Brazil by Lula's right-wing predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro.
Se abre una nueva época en las relaciones.
A new era is opening up in the relations between our countries, between our people. And this new era must include the construction of a new map of cooperation, of joint work that encompasses all areas.
Venezuela has always been an exceptional partner for Brazil, but because of political contingencies and mistakes, President Maduro has not been in Brazil for 8 years, and Brazil has been without Venezuela for a long time.
O Brasil ficou muito tempo sem ir a Venezuela.
Under Bolsonaro's administration, Brazil supported Venezuela's opposition leader, Juan Guaido's unsuccessful bid to claim Venezuela's presidency. Furthermore, Colombia's leftist president, Gustavo Petro, has moved to ease tensions with Venezuela following years of hostility. Maduro also said his nation wants to be part of the BRICS group of leading emerging nations, with Lula saying he would personally favor a bid from Venezuela to join it. Peruvian President Dina Boluarte is the only absentee. The Boluarte government has faced growing diplomatic isolation in Latin America over its response to countrywide protests following the ouster of left-wing former president Pedro Castillo. This is the first summit of regional leaders since 2014 in Ecuador at a gathering of UNASUR, a continental bloc launched in 2008 by Lula and Maduro's mentor, late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. That was the moment of Latin America's so-called pink tide of left-wing governments in the region. Some analysts are talking of a new pink tide with the election of Lula, Chile's Boric and Colombia's Gustavo Petro. After Lula defeated Bolsonaro in a divisive election, he has been overhauling Brazil's foreign policy, vowing to seek friendly relations across the board and cultivating closer ties with different partners. Lula's government has also touted projects such as Bi-Oceanic Corridor, a transportation artery to enable countries to ship goods across the continent overland instead of by sea.
And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Palestinians say the Zionist regime's siege on Gaza has crippled the enclave's economy. The fishing zone for the Gazans currently extends to only between 11 kilometers and 28 kilometers off the Gaza coast. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, "It is early morning, sunny but with a cool breeze. Jihad al-Hissi is busy helping fellow fishers to prepare a boat for a day at sea. There should not be anything unusual about the tasks they perform. Fishers around the world do them all the time. Yet the tension is almost palpable. Jihad 56 is worried that his boat will not return to the port. For 8 months last year, the boat was held by Israeli authorities after its crew ventured a short distance beyond the small zone in which Gaza's fishers are permitted to operate. Being away from the vessel was heartbreaking for Jihad. Feeding our families was very hard during those months," he said, adding, "All we know how to do is in life is fish." Eventually, the boat, named Al-Hajj Rajab, after Jihad's father, was released to him under strict conditions. He was required to pay approximately $5,500 and warned that he may not go further than 3 nautical miles from the shoreline. Jihad fears that the boat could be seized once again at any moment. The Israeli regime authorities have initiated court proceedings in an effort to confiscate the boat permanently. The ordeal began on February 14, 2022. On that day, Jihad's brother, Nihad, was captaining the boat. Nihad and other members of his extended family were lowering their nets into the sea when 3 Israeli regime naval vessels approached them at high speed. The Israelis attacked Nihad and his crew with rubber-coated steel bullets and water cannons. Once they were beside the boat, 3 Israeli regime commandos jumped on board, screaming and continuing to shoot. Nihad said, "They even used electric shock weapons on us several times. It was the most terrifying and cruel experience of my life," he added. "Not only because I was in danger, but because it was hard to see my sons and nephews injured and in handcuffs." All 6 fishers, including Nihad, were arrested and brought to Ashdod, a naval base in the occupied territories of Palestine. Later, the fishers were taken to the Erez military checkpoint, which separates the occupied territories and Gaza. They were interrogated before being released in the late evening. The excuse offered by the Zionist regime for its brutality was that the boat was outside the permitted fishing area. Nihad pointed out that it is often impossible to catch enough fish inside the permitted zone. Fishers have to go farther in the hope they will have a large enough daily catch. Otherwise, their activities would not be economically viable. Under the Oslo Accords signed between the Zionist regime and the Palestine Liberation Organization in the 1990s, Gaza's fishers may venture up to 20 nautical miles from the shore. The Zionist regime has not respected the accords. The Zionist regime has repeatedly changed the limits applying to fishers. At times, this regime has reduced the zone as little as 3 nautical miles and even banned fishers from going to sea completely for certain periods. While naval attacks on Gaza's fishers are frequent, the court proceedings the Zionist regime has initiated against the Al-Hessi family is regarded as unprecedented. According to Gisha, an Israeli human rights group, the authorities are wrongly trying to invoke provisions of international law. These provisions concern the seizure of enemy ships and, in Gisha's view, should not be applied to civilians. It is deeply ironic that the Zionist regime is posing as a defender of international law in this case. The restrictions the Israeli regime has imposed on fishers and the violence to which this regime has subjected them constitutes collective punishment. That crime is outlawed by the 4th Geneva Convention, a cornerstone of international law. Al-Mizan, a Gaza-based human rights group, has found that the Zionist regime carried out hundreds of attacks on Palestinian fishers in 2022 alone. Such attacks have continued in the first few months of this year. The Zionist regime's seizure of his boat caused major problems for Jihad. As he had no income, his debts mounted. And when the boat was finally handed back to him, it had sustained serious damage. Some of the damage resulted directly from the attack. Other damage resulted from the boat's engine being exposed to the elements during the 8 months it was kept in Ashdod. Repairing it cost approximately $11,000. Jihad also lost nets and other fishing gear that had been cast into the sea just before the attack occurred. Replacing the equipment cost an additional $10,000. Jihad had to borrow heavily so that he could pay those bills. While many fishers have left the profession since the Zionist regime imposed the full blockade on the Gaza Strip in 2007, Jihad is determined to keep plying his trade. He regards it as his duty to do so, as he comes from a family of fishers. He recalls hearing stories that his father told him about working as a fisher in Jaffa. The family hails from that port city in historic Palestine. They moved to Gaza after being uprooted during the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Jihad said, "Even when my boat was taken away from me, I insisted on going down to the port in Gaza every morning. Life away from the sea's breeze is unbearable." In the meantime, Wafa News Agency reported on May 1st, 2023, Israeli regime navy attacked Palestinian fishermen while sailing off the northwest shores of Gaza City, injuring two and arresting two others. According to the fishermen union committees in the Gaza Strip, two Palestinian fishermen were shot and injured by Israeli regime's navy's rubber-coated steel bullets, including an injury to the head, while sailing within 3 nautical miles offshore the northwest of Gaza City. Israeli regime navy troops reportedly surrounded the boat, attacked it with rubber-coated steel bullets and water cannons, shooting and injuring two people. They were taken to hospital for medical treatment. In the meantime, Israeli regime army and bulldozers on May 1st infiltrated Gaza borders from the eastern part of Khan Yunis city in southern Gaza Strip and razed land in the area. Sources said that 7 Israeli military vehicles accompanied by bulldozers raided agricultural land to the east of the town Khaza, east of Khan Yunis, where they leveled land and vandalized Palestinian agricultural properties.
Hidden Files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, people who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the war on terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the war on terror today. But was this war on terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter. United States Marine Corps intelligence officer who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted, this was unjust, this was horrible, and we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, don't you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections. And so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, own between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin. Total sales, $46.5 billion. Gross profit, $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing. Total sales, $68.7 billion. Gross profit, $4 billion. 3. BAE. Total sales, $30.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics. Total sales, $32.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman. Total sales, $26.4 billion. Gross profit, $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Lalkar. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001, was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq. And famously, Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said, it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said, in around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact the list of 7 other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon and White House, because let's not forget it was all 3 sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, you know, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, you know, U.S. a right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. You know, it was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy, they would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the U.S. state and in particular U.S. companies, you know, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going in. Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout U.S. diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the U.S., and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important Iraq has perhaps 10 to 15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. U.S. has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many U.S. defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, you know, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, there were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, you know, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact its constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game. But that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashimi, and all the crew here on Hidden Files.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies.
31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.